Okay, everyone, welcome to Free For All, the show of libertarian issues that comes to you from Grumblings Media. This is your host, Big John, reminding you to catch us on grumblingsmedia.com, YouTube, Rumble, Twitter, any podcasting platform, Spotify, Pandora, Apple. Basically, just look for at Grumblings Media, all one word, at Grumblings Media. And I rushed through all that pimping for one specific reason. One of my favorite guests is back on the show. We interviewed him, I think, almost a year to the day it's been since he was last on the show. We interviewed him the first time around. He gave us a little bit of insight into himself. And I always said, I like this guy running for LP for the nomination for president. I still like this guy. I'm not going to say if I'm pulling the lever or not for him, because that would be unfair to everybody else. But you can see the enthusiasm on this ugly face. I like this gentleman, everyone, Mr. Mike Termott. Mike, how you doing today?
I'm doing well. It's great to be with you. It's great to be on your big show. And as always, increasingly, I appreciate the name of your program, Free For All, because it is anything goes. It is chaos. And I'm just happy to be with you.
Thank you so much, Mike. Like I said, this is more of an issues-driven show, so I'm going to dive right into it. When you feel you don't want to answer a question, you'll let me know. But Mike already told me before we started the show, there's nothing off limits with him. He wants to address everything. So we'll see how much we can get to today, Mike. Let's start off with some low-hanging fruit for libertarians. But I want to get your sort of quote-unquote official position on it, which is the so-called TikTok ban. The House resolution that passed about essentially, it was all about TikTok. There's language in there that makes it more generalized. But I also think that's the more surreptitious part of it. Mike, tell us a little bit about this, your position on it, and why people who are interested in individual liberty should be particularly concerned about this type of resolution coming out of the House.
Yeah, I appreciate that. The idea behind the legislation is to protect people from TikTok, because we all believe, I think correctly so, by the way, that TikTok is an entity that could easily be controlled by the government of the People's Republic of China. Anyone who has looked at the relationship between Chinese companies and the Chinese government knows the Chinese government can ask for anything they want at any point in time. Most large companies actually are required to have representatives of the Communist Party physically on location in their organizations, just to make sure that the Communist Party can exert control when they need to. But even if they don't have anyone, you know, sitting at a desk in your shop, if you're going to be allowed to continue to do business, you're going to have to provide whatever it is, right? Information, or you're going to have to conduct business in the way that the government wants you to conduct business. And so whether it has been made explicit or not, it is true that the entity that controls TikTok will always, as long as it remains a Chinese company, will always be subject to the control of the Chinese government. So that is true. You know, we need to at least have a common fact base here, right? And sure. And as libertarians, we need to acknowledge that as the truth. It is also true, I believe. I am not necessarily, I'm not a social media expert, right? Like you, I've spent a lot of time with social media. I've raised a couple of kids. Look, I get it. If my kids were little, rather than 29 and 31 as they are, right? If my kids were little, I would be deeply concerned with all of their interactions on social media, not just TikTok. Right. And I think it is probably true that TikTok does some things that are not good for us as individuals, probably does some things that are not terribly good for us in terms of our family, and almost certainly not good for us in terms of our society. I don't mind acknowledging that all of that is likely true as well. I'm not here to represent that that's necessarily worse than any other particular social media platform. But I'm not going to defend TikTok itself, right?
Right.
And I hasten to reiterate, I'm not someone who has, in any formal sense, studied, you know, the effects of various social media platforms. But I think it's important that we acknowledge that there are things about which people should be concerned.
Sure.
Now, having said that.
Yeah, and I was going to jump in before you go on to the next one. Actually, that's a great point because I actually have a former high school classmate of mine, so 40 years ago maybe, who's actually one of the leading
40
experts.
40 weeks ago. Go ahead.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you, sir. He's actually one of the foremost, Dr. Nick Kadaris, he's one of the foremost experts on digital addiction and the effects on society. And he has for the life of me, I can't remember the title of his book, but it was out recently. But that is a great point, that there is this societal challenge that comes with social media, not just TikTok. I mean, certainly Facebook, Twitter might be the worst of all, right? In terms of that digital sort of like, we're changing the makeup of our society. Now, I don't know if that's necessarily good or bad, or if these are growing pains or something that is built into the structure of social media, that its overall effects are negative. I'm willing to have an open mind about that. But to your point,
agreed.
you've just described a fact set. You've just described a societal issue. But I think all of us know as libertarians, when society is the victim, we really don't think there's a crime, correct? So when you have this bill coming out of Congress that says like, hey, guess what, folks? We're going to take care of you because we're going to ban TikTok. We're going to ban all TikTok-like companies. And it's very important. It's not for their effect, but because of their political implications, their national implications, right? So now, give me your caveat. Why is it that this is bad after you've just described like, hey, we may be in the middle of a horrible societal situation right now?
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, I like the way that you set it up further, because there's a, you know, there's an important difference between there being a problem and there being a problem requiring a government solution.
Correct.
I don't like the idea that the federal government of the United States, or any government of the United States, or any government anywhere, would suggest that they're going to fix this problem for us. And I think that that's problematic on a couple of different levels. Number one, just as an empirical, just objectively speaking, governments are not good at fixing these types of problems.
Oh, sure.
You know, they tend to be relatively ham-handed, right? Oh, you know, we're going to just kill TikTok. Okay, what are you going to do about the next platform that has similar problems? You're going to kill that one too. So, you know, we're going to kill all of social media. The other thing I think that we need to recognize is, I think it's probably true. No, I think it's certainly true that you can trust the Communist Party and the People's Republic of China, their government, much less than you can trust other governments. I'll give you that.
Sure.
But I want to jump in here and say, I don't have a tremendous level of trust for the federal government of the United States.
Mm.
And I don't mean to say, you know, I'm the conspiracy theorist that's trying to convince you of all kinds of dark things that the CIA has done. That's another show. We can have that discussion because I think there is some important things there that we need to thrash out.
Sure.
But set that aside just for a moment. This is the same organization that covered up something. However you feel about, you know, the COVID regime and however you feel about the virus and vaccines. Right. This is the same organization that decided certain information was not good for you.
Right.
That decided to hide certain information. In some cases, even, you know, it appears as though now that they lied to us about certain information, and then pressured, this is the important angle, social media companies into doing their bidding regarding suppressing certain types of information.
And continuing to do it, by the way.
And continuing to do it, by the way, even though we've identified that they do this. They weren't like so embarrassed that they went back underneath a rock and said, oh, I'm sorry, we won't do that again.
Right, exactly.
Which, I mean, if you or I were caught doing something that stupid, we would be embarrassed beyond functionality.
It is literally, they got caught with their hand in the cookie jar and they're still stuffing their face with Oreos, right?
It's like, look what I'm doing. Look what I'm continuing to do.
Right, right.
Look, I can't help it.
Right.
And so I think it's a bit rich that this organization, the federal government of the United States, wants to save us from another national government by doing something that, from doing something to us that's not completely different from what they themselves have done. There are different angles. I'm not trying to say it's exactly the same thing. It's not. It's not the same thing. But nor is it a completely different category. We're talking about governments wanting to manipulate in a two-way street, you know, the use of information and what information they're right. giving us, wanting to manipulate that flow of information. And yeah. so if I did believe, and I don't, but if I did believe that someone out there should be protecting my family from TikTok, it would not be the federal government of the United States. It might be you. Hmm. I would feel better if Big John were to announce, I'm pulling this out of my ear right now, right?
Sure,
but,
sure.
But work with me here for a minute. I would be more comfortable if Big John announced, you know what? I'm getting my buddy Kaderis and a dozen other really smart people together.
Right.
And we're going to come up with some plans on how to deal with this. We're going to come up with some recommendations. And we're going to engage some high-tech folks to develop filters, apps that we can use to protect our kids on our phones. And we're going to demand open source interaction with TikTok and other platforms so that we can engage these filter apps. And if you don't provide us this, you know, open sourced interaction capability, then we are going to block on our individual phones TikTok.
Right.
Because remember, at the end of the day, you don't have to use TikTok.
Right.
You can stop on your own. You can stop your kids from using
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
And ultimately, no matter how dangerous it might be, the responsibility has to remain with us as individuals and us as parents.
I agree with you. And the thing that I find, I mean, there's so many layers to this that I find objectionable, as I'm sure you do. One of them is that part of the foreign actor control and whatever language they had in that HR bill, which when I read through it was amazingly Orwellian, and I don't think anybody bothered to hide it. And in this case, they used the specificity of TikTok, even in the bill, like when they cite examples, they cite TikTok. Then they subtly generalize it to the point where it's like any foreign actor under the control of any foreign corporation that has at least a 20% ownership by someone that we deem is a foreign actor, even if there's no particular evidence. And by the way, that determination comes at the sole discretion of the president, right? One person.
We, the government, gets to decide who it is that we're going to force to do our bidding.
And so you have that part of it, which I agree with you is scary enough, right? But then you have the second part of it, of the forced sale of TikTok. Like, if you want to do business with us, we can't have you dirty foreigners running your own company. You have to sell it, by gosh, to an American. And just coincidentally, the day after this bill was passed by the House, in a bipartisan fashion, by the way, which again, in today's thing, is a red flag. Guess who stepped up to the plate? Steve Mnuchin stepped up to the plate to say, hey, I just happened to have an investor group to buy TikTok. So you can have an American-owned company spying on you instead of a Chinese company spying on you.
Is that the slimiest thing of the week? And in a week full of slime, that's one of the slimiest stories of all that I think went relatively underappreciated. Good for you for flagging it. For the rest of your audience who might not, you know, be swimming in minutia. Steve Mnuchin is a former Treasury Secretary, formerly Goldman Sachs, and obviously a very wealthy guy. I have no doubt that he could pull this off. But the whole idea that a former government official, not just a government official, but a political operative, right, would be involved in taking advantage of a forced divestiture, forced by our legislature. Wow, that is slimy. Now, put yourself in the shoes. This will be harder to do. But put yourself in the shoes of a foreign investor. You're thinking about doing business in the United States. Is this going to make you want to do business more or less?
Sure.
A lot less. I'm not sure the United States is creating the type of environment in which I want to do business. All of a sudden, because of a mood swing, they could force a divestiture, at which point I'm selling at, you know, 75 cents on the dollar because I got to get out of Dodge in a hurry.
Right.
That's the reason why so many American companies don't want to do business in China, because they're afraid that the Chinese government is going to change the rules out from under them. And all of a sudden they're going to be stuck in a bad spot. These kinds of rules make it difficult for us to recruit capital to come in and make investments in the United States, which of course is what we want to expand our economy and to drive up our wage rate. So this whole thing is just completely counterproductive.
It is horrible on so many levels. And I know the initial thing that most libertarians jumped on was the free speech angle, which agreed, you know, that is a huge concern. But I think a lot of these subtleties that you just mentioned, just from an economic point of view, from the point of view of the sliminess of it, think about it. This is passing. Now, thankfully, I think I'm not 100% sure this bill will make it through the Senate. So there's hope in there that, because I heard Durbin is against it, I heard Rand Paul's against it. So maybe there's enough of a sort of coalition.
And it's harder to get things through the Senate anyway.
Well, that's true as well. But I'm hoping it kind of dies there. But it is interesting to me. And for those, like I say, you know, it was passed and Biden says he'll sign it. So you know it's got the Democrat support. And yet here you have a Trump appointee cabinet member saying, I'll buy it and run it. So there's sliminess. There's sliminess on both sides of this.
And slime to go around.
It's like not even the common sense to wait a week to say, you know, I really didn't want to do this, but I'll buy it. You know
that's one of the weirdest things about it is why he couldn't wait. And by the way, he must have dozens of rich and famous friends.
Sure.
I'm not sure you want a government official to be, you know, the poster boy for your investor team, because it just looks like.
Right.
And by the way, outside of the United States, it must look even worse. I mean, inside the United States, maybe there's a million people who trust Steve. I don't know a million people that trust Steve, but maybe. Right. But outside the United States, it just looks like government forced divestiture and a government actor ready to take it over. That's the kind of thing that we make fun of when we see it in Europe or Asian or Latin America.
It is literally a mafia tactic. I don't understand why this is so unclear to people. It is clearly a mob tactic. You know, like, you can't have this store because it goes against the community. But by the way, we'll buy it. We'll take it off your hands.
We're going to do you a favor.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
Right. So, and then they burn a photograph of your laundromat in front of you on the desk. And that's supposed to make you feel better. By the way.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I know it's your show and I should let you talk once in a while.
That's okay. Go ahead.
In 1996, when we passed the Communications Decency Act, which of course was completely indecent.
Sure.
And yes, your audience is probably too young to have been very involved in online policy in 1996, but I was already worried about it because I had to be. And the government, in order to, it started in the House, but it became law. The government wanted to make it possible for social media. We didn't call it social media in those days. They wanted to make it possible for social media platforms to conduct censorship. Now, what they wanted was for social media platforms to get rid of porn, right? Or as they called it, the term of art in those days was smut. Okay. They were smut fighters.
Sure.
And, you know, who doesn't love to fight smut? So everybody politically was on board so that these platforms would have the right to fight smut without subjecting themselves to everything that they would be subjected to if courts found that they were publishers, right? They claimed we're not publishers, we're just platforms. So you can't sue us for all the stupid things that are on our platform. But we'll help you fight smut. And this law was giving us protection from liability for being sued as publishers. So, okay, great. But then, because you said something really interesting a few minutes ago about loosening up the language a little bit to make it so that you could drive a truck through that loophole. In the 1996 law, they said, you know, to fight smut or other things objectionable. Something, the word objectionable was in there.
Right.
So now what happens, you know, you fast forward 25 years.
Sure.
And now the social media companies, they really do act as publishers. They edit, you know, they advance certain things, they suppress, they repress. And in many cases, as we've learned, they just do the government's bidding in terms of taking certain things down. And yet the reason they're allowed to do that is because the government wants them to do that and change the law to allow them to do that. And all of a sudden the horse is out of the barn and here we are.
Right. I agree with you. So sort of to wrap this up, because I think we kind of did it, like, so in watching some old Milton Milton Friedman videos, you know, there was a similar type of question where he was being asked, you know, he was for the abolishment of the FDA, obviously, but he said, hey, listen, if you want a halfway house type of answer, to whether or not the FDA should exist, how about this one? Allow it to exist, but only as an information body, meaning that the FDA could issue its opinions, but they would carry no regulatory weight. So, for example, we think smoking causes lung cancer. Here's our evidence. But if you want to smoke cigarettes, go ahead, which, by the way, is what happens, right? Would you be in favor of something similar where the government could issue a warning saying, like, look, we've determined or we've come to the conclusion that TikTok is a CCP app. If you use it, there is a high probability that all your personal information on your phone or your desktop is going to end up in the hands of the Chinese government, if that means anything to them. But that's it. That's where it ends. Would you be okay with that type of function, or would you rather just...
Great, 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 great question. The answer is no, 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 no. Now, the reason is not because that's such a bad outcome per se. I mean, that sounds pretty nice, right? Mm. I mean, it does sound like it's halfway. It sounds like, you know, you would get the information. A lot of smart people, I'm sure, would go into developing those opinions, and we would all be better off, and food would taste better, and we'd be safer, and beer would be colder. It would be a great world. Unfortunately, that's not what happens. I almost said that's not what would happen, but it's actually not what does happen in the real world. And the reason for that is a couple different things. One is there's a lot of lobbying that goes on. And number two, there is a natural tendency for people to try to gain more power. And what I mean by the lobbying is not merely people standing in lobbies trying to get their opinions out. That happens too. So, you know, you never really know whether you're getting the opinion of the government official or, you know, his brother-in-law who is working for Raytheon, right? But there are all kinds of relationships that can be corrupted. For example, we know that the Anthony Fauci's of the world, legally, John, legally participate in royalties from the pharmaceutical companies' developments and sales of products that are approved by government agencies.
Right. Yeah.
Wow. And so these things just sort of organically happen, you know, over time, these relationships with the between the government and scientific companies.
Sure.
Whether you're in the business of creating something, whether you're in the business of selling something or merely just studying it, you're going to get biases. And of course, the other problem is that the corruption can extend to the point where those relationships eventually induce government officials to do things that aren't within their mandates. You know, you start out with, well, my job is to provide information. Okay. Now my job is to provide information to you. not just information, right?
Gotcha.
But yep. Now my job is to make sure you get certain information and not other information. You can already see where this is going.
Sure.
My job is to make sure the governor of your state doesn't give you information that's bad.
I got you.
Now all of a sudden I'm into fights with other government agencies and you're off to the races and, you know, a regulatory framework is right around the corner.
See, the only problem with that I have, Mike, and I feel you when you say that, is at what point does it become self-defeating? You know, because I wanted to touch on this later in the show and maybe we'll save it for that, but just keep in the back of your head, like, as libertarians, do we always run the risk of becoming so anti-government that we forget to be pro-individual? That's like the general premise that I want to ask you in a few minutes.
I think it's a great question. Let's come back to that, but let's also let your audience mull over very important counterexamples.
Sure.
Like United Laboratories, which is not a government organization. That don't very much anymore exist because the government has crowded them out of these businesses, crowded them out of these markets.
Sure.
And that's very important. It's important to recognize that universities are going to conduct a lot of research, whether the government is funding them or not, mm-hmm. but you trust it less when the government is asking for research in a particular direction.
Agree.
That's what's problematic. It's also important to remember that the vast majority of, virtually all, standardization in our economy, whether it's, you know, making sure your light switches work with your outlets and making sure that your credit card interfaces with your ATM and, you know, all the standardization protocols in our economy, of which there are hundreds of thousands, you know, not dozens.
Yes.
All that takes place in the private sector.
Yeah.
And it's important, I think, for us to remember that when we say we don't want government to do this or that, that doesn't mean that we're suggesting that this or that is a bad idea. We just believe that someone else needs to do it, which is why I say I really think, and now the more I think about it, I think that maybe you are a good example. You know, I started out sarcastic, but now I'm talking myself into it. I think that you should get together a bunch of experts and come up with some protocols for us to protect ourselves from TikTok.
Well, you know, okay. Let's talk about it now. I'll rearrange my schedule on the fly here, but here's the examples I'm thinking of. For example, you and I know we have sort of like a shared background, not personally, but just in parallel career paths. We were both on Wall Street at one point. We were both around for the birth of this internet thing and how it got integrated into business, so on and so forth. So I think we have like a shared history like that. I'm sure you and I remember the time when there may have been hundreds of different PCs you could have bought for yourself, all with 100 different operating systems and none of them compatible with each other. Right? Like if you bought a Microsoft-based thing, if you bought a Tandy-based thing, if for those old enough to shake the cobwebs, right? The market figured out the standardization. To your point, contrary to what people think, Apple wasn't the first company to say everything is plug and play. It was actually IBM. But then IBM couldn't keep up with Apple's innovations. And Apple's a walled garden. Windows, Microsoft is an open sort of playground. Then you had the other. So the market figured it out with little to no government intervention, right? Trial and error. Some people got burned. That's the nature of a free market and of free enterprise and free thought. Viruses, antiviruses. Wasn't the government. It was the John McAfees, the Jim Nortons, the John Nortons of the world. So when you see history, especially in technology, the market is far more efficient in identifying and finding solutions than the government ever will be, right? So I understand your point there. I think, though, there are certain subjects that the level of expertise becomes increasingly more difficult, right? And I'm thinking, and I'm not saying that this becomes solely the province of the government, Mike, but how many of us are in a position to understand truly immunology, oncology, there's a reason why it takes forever to get in a position to call yourself an oncologist or to be able to treat people. Again, I'm against medical licensure. I'm against the FDA. But I think as libertarians, we'd be foolish. And I truly believe this. And this is where I sort of break away from the anarchist or the ANCAP side of our party. Hey, if my son were to get sick, I'm not taking him to somebody down the street who tells me they read something on the internet about how to cure his condition, right? I'm going to seek out the best medical person, obviously someone with a little snow on the rooftop because they've had some experience, right? Someone, and I'll talk to my neighbors and stuff. Do you see that as a, see, that's where I'm trying to say, is there a line there that we have to be aware of? And that's what I meant, that are we becoming so anti-government that we forget to be pro-individual as libertarians?
I appreciate that. I'm going to give you another chance to make a better case. Fair enough. Because I don't think the case you just made is going to win all of what your argument could win.
Yeah.
Because we don't go to the government to pick a surgeon or an oncologist or an internist now. Correct. You know, you don't go to the Obamacare website or the, you know, State of New York website to find a good doctor now. You know, right. You might ask your personal physician to recommend someone. You might call the hospital. You might check with the AMA, your insurance company probably right. is what narrows it down to two for you right away.
Right.
And, you know, whoever has the best demeanor on the phone when you call their office is going to be the sure. winner. Sure. So, you know, I get all that, but it's not the government that helps us in this regard anyway. You know, if someone hasn't done their 5-year residency on top of their internship and then trained in, you know, in the specific orthopedic oncology, I'm not, you know, going to that gal or guy when, you know, I have to have an osteosarcoma removed. It's just not going to happen. And there's no amount right. of information the government can give me to suggest that I'm going to settle for anything less than that. And I don't think there's any amount of information the government can give me beyond what I can get from the AMA and from the hospitals. So I don't know that that's a great example. But what I would say is that there are examples where the government dominates the flow of information. And so we sort of naturally look to the FDA, you know, dominates the dissemination of certain types of information. And so we've grown accustomed to, well, is it FDA approved? You know, that's right. that's what's really going to make me feel good. And I think that that's a problem more than a solution. Mm. Because I think that the reason we have grown accustomed to trusting the FDA is because they have forced themselves in. Whereas if they hadn't, there'd be someone else that we'd be trusting. And now we learn that there are entire regimes outside the United States that a lot of doctors are saying work better than ours. And whether that's, you know, you can get pharmaceuticals cheaper in Canada, or whether you can get an antibiotic over the counter in Asia, you know, there are better ways of doing business that are very difficult to conduct in the United States, where one single agency controls so much. You know, back to your interesting layout in terms of technology, you were speaking a lot about interoperability.
Sure.
But it plays out in other ways as well. One of the, you know, we look at the technology churn of companies and we all lament when a company goes down and people lose their jobs and there's hell to pay. I get that. But in the long run, I think we all recognize that a tremendous amount of value is created and a tremendous amount of money is saved because we have a system that allows failure. When the sure. FDA screws up, it keeps going.
Yeah.
And the call is actually typically for it to get bigger and stronger.
Yeah, no, I agree. And you know, that creative destruction that Schumpeter loved so much and coined the phrase and everything. I agree with you. I am all for that. I just think that I'm a big Milton Friedman guy, which is why I'm not an ANCAP, but that halfway house solution of his, see, the key to me is always when you take away the regulatory and coercive nature of these agencies. So to the extent that maybe the FDA got thalidomide right, and again, there's proof that they just got lucky because they take so long to approve drugs. They just got lucky with thalidomide. There's that, you know, but let's give them the benefit of the doubt. Let's say we're optimists and we give them the benefit of the doubt, and they prevented thalidomide from being released in the U.S. Without the regulatory bite behind it, to your point, people will naturally understand that it's either a useful government function or a useless government. And, you know, so to me, if I have the FDA spouting off and they have no power to prevent me from taking a drug or acquiring a drug or regulating a drug, then I either come to trust them the way I would a private organ, like Consumer Reports or whatever else, the way I may or may not trust them. Because to me, when people make the corruption argument, corruption to me, it's like the K in any mathematical equation, right? It's a constant. No matter what variable you talk about, when it comes to public life, there's always going to be corruption. What's to prevent the UL from being bought off? What's to prevent, right?
You're right. You're right.
So the difference with government is always going to be the coercive, the legal coercive ability of the government. So I think once we eliminate that, I'm not so anti-government to, if they happen to get together the best or the most knowledgeable people on a subject, I have no problem with that. And if any taxes are going to be collected, that's fine. You know, like if they want to make some recommendations, I'm okay with it. As long as they can't force me. The corruption, I agree with you, exists. The lobbying will exist, but that would exist in the private market anyway, right? So anything that provides an opinion is subject to corruption. That's all there is to it, in my opinion. That's a constant. That's a K, Mike. So
I agree with you. I think that that is well said, actually. In answer to your rhetorical question, what's from stopping a UL from being corrupted? The answer is the market will cause that organization to fail once it has been revealed to have been corrupted.
Sure. Yes.
Whereas when the FDA is revealed to have been corrupted, we give it more money so it can protect itself from corruption. We give it more oversight, and then we keep on plugging away. And I think that that's an important difference.
I agree with you. I agree with you. So I think we could leave it at that. Like I'm willing to give them a shot. You're not. That's cool though, but because I think we agree the key is to take away their regulatory ability and their coercive ability. Okay, great stuff. Yep. I want to move on to the next subject right now. So we take a breath or sip of water or whatever. I'll give you a chance. Let's talk about immigration. Let's talk about what's happening at the southern border. Let's talk about the conflict between state sovereignty, federal oversight, federal regulation. And I'll throw this in there, Mike, for part three when you're done with your answer so you can start formulating it now. I am concerned not with the libertarian position of whether you're open borders, regulated borders, closed borders. That concerns me less than the what I find to be a troubling turn towards nationalism with respect to how, I'm using the common phrase, illegal immigrants, illegal aliens are regarded as people. Not their status, not how they're traveling and how to handle that piece, but using the immigration issue as an excuse for nationalistic tendency. So I threw a lot at you. I'm going to give you a second while I finish talking to think of your answer and go.
I agree with everything you said to such an extent that I don't even think we need to talk about it. I think that we should move on to another. Right on the nose, right on the nose. Right on the nose. Look, that's the short answer. Now we're going to spend the next 20 minutes on this, and I know sure. We are, and I'm happy to because I think it's so important. But you have just rung a bell that should not be unrung.
Okay.
I think it's important for us to say out loud, immigration is good for America. And it's good for America in a few different, very important ways. First of all, it is good for us culturally. It is good for us in terms of our identity. It's one of the things that makes America, America. There are a few things as American as immigration. And by the way, that immigration has to be among people with whom you are unfamiliar. If you're just bringing over family members from the same town as your grandpa came from, that doesn't count,
right?
In some sense, right?
Right, right.
You know, just because their recipe for borscht is different than your mama's, that doesn't make it really the type of immigration that I'm talking about.
Right.
It is per se the lack of familiarity. It is that makes us what we are.
Right.
And that is an important distinction from other democracies around the world. Not only are we a democracy that, a republic, all right, let's not get too far down that rabbit hole. Not only are we a constitutional democratic republic that believes in pluralism, but we are a society that is forced to by immigration, forced to be tolerant of each other, forced to recognize that we need to give First Amendment rights and all of the other constitutional protections to people who are not like us. That is a very important fundamental. That to me is more fundamental than our Constitution. It's more fundamental than other aspects of our society. It's more fundamental than the way our economy works, is that we need to recognize that my lifestyle, as perfect as it is, John, as perfect as my lifestyle is not something that should be my business to try to impose on anybody else.
Correct. Yeah.
So anyway, immigration is good for us. It is good for us also economically, and it is good for us financially, as long as you're not doing something stupid like giving away a lot of free money to people coming across the border. And we all agree on this. Let's set that aside for a moment, because that's a bit of a separate issue and arguably a red herring. You cannot be anti-immigration because we've got stupid welfare policy, which we do. I mean, we do have stupid welfare policy. We have stupid policy regarding the way that we give money away in all kinds of ways, right? So we need to stop doing stupid things. Right. I don't like it when we say, well, I do lots of stupid things, so, you know, we can't have immigration. Like, what's wrong with you? Like, stop doing the stupid shit and, you know, grow up and recognize that immigration is good for us. Now, I do think it's important to say that legal immigration is good for us and illegal immigration is not good for us. And what I mean by that, and this comes really from not just a long-term appreciation, but profoundly. I spent a couple days at the Arizona-Mexico border last year, and I really came away jilted, you know, affected by the extent to which we have a human trafficking problem. It is true that most people who come into the United States come in illegally. It is also true that most people who come into the United States illegally come in through some form of human trafficker, whether you call it a gang or a coyote or some, you know, perverted uncle, one way or another, you are getting to that border in more than 50% of the cases through the service of someone you should not be trusting. Let me just say it like that.
Yeah.
And then in most cases, you are handed off to someone on the other side. You know, you might not call them human traffickers the way I do, but you are handed off to someone with a telephone app on the other side whom you don't know, whom you shouldn't be trusting. And in far too many cases, you are delivered into some sense of indentured servitude. And that can look every bit as hellacious as your imagination would allow. This is something that we should not be tolerating. This is something that is bad for the individuals involved. It is bad for us societally. It is bad for our, by the way, is bad for our law enforcement. The way this was brought to my attention was spending some time with the sheriff's office. They have a hard time stopping young deputies from chasing, which is against their policy, right? Mm-hmm. As it is in most law enforcement agencies now, you're not supposed to chase for anything less than a violent felony, right? Because the automobile chases are so dangerous.
Dangerous, right?
And we get that. They're having a hard time stopping deputies from chasing because the deputies, even if you're only, you know, a 22-year-old kid, they know what's going, they know what's at stake. They know what's at stake. It's not because, you know, it's hard to control law enforcement officers anyway. You know, you got 22-year-old young men.
Yeah, let me jump in here for those that don't know. And Mike is speaking from experience as a former law enforcement officer, a libertarian cop, to hang that sort of thing on him. So when you talk about these things, you're talking from firsthand experience, as well as policy and what you've seen as you travel the country, right? So when you say, look, as a practical matter, these young deputies, these seasoned deputies in some cases, you're going to have trouble chasing them, which in fact is more dangerous, perhaps, than the actual alleged criminal you're chasing, purported to be chasing,
all the
right?
Time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. And you're right. I was a training officer for several years, and it is hard to stop young men. And by young, I mean anyone under the age of 100. It is hard to stop guys. And by the way, it's hard to stop plenty of young women who work in law enforcement officer in law enforcement also from chasing when they know there is evil afoot, right? Policy be damned. It is hard to hold back when you feel like, when you feel like if I don't get there, right? If I don't stop this, someone's life is going to be profoundly undermined, damaged in some sense. It is difficult. Anyway, this was the way, I apologize, this is the way this was brought to my attention, is that you've got these whole communities of people who are born in the United States who are so deeply affected at an emotional level, right? Who want this shut down. They don't have the resources to shut it down. The federal government doesn't seem to have any interest in dedicating the resources required to shut it down. And I think that there's two things that we need to do policy-wise simultaneously. One is to get people through faster legally and slower illegally. And I think that they go hand in hand. In other words, one of the things that we could do to slow down illegal immigration is to speed up legal immigration. And I appreciate the fact that most Americans, and by most, I think I mean almost everybody, wants some form of vetting at the border, right? Americans don't want a completely open border. But that doesn't mean that we should be going through days, weeks, months, years to vet someone across. That is utter BS.
Sure.
You know, this idea that we can't figure out whether or not you're on a list. You know, if you're not on a terrorist watch list, by the way, that's a whole other conversation, how people shouldn't be on these lists that are.
Right.
But if you're not on that list and your home government doesn't have a warrant for your arrest, and I do appreciate the fact that this means technology to allow us interface with those databases, right? But if you're not on one of those lists, then we should establish that rapidly and vet you across the border. This is good for the United States. And that would be one of the things that would take away the incentive to come over illegally. Because when you come over illegally, not only are you subjected to the human trafficking element, but you find it more difficult to get work. And when you find it more difficult to get work, it increases the chances that you will commit a crime. It also dramatically increases the chances that you will be either in indentured servitude or that you will accept an oppressively low wage rate for someone who's going to take advantage of the fact that you can't work legally.
Yeah.
So, and that's, by the way, what undermines our wage structure for everybody else. So this whole idea that, you know, a lot of people don't want too much immigration because they're afraid it'll undermine the wage rate. What undermines the wage rate is everybody coming through illegally. It's not the people coming through legally who in many cases won't accept a wage rate less than anybody else would. But we need to get people in the United States and get them working. This idea that we tell them they shouldn't be working, I think, is backwards. I would be much more comfortable with a policy that says, yeah, I'm going to call you in 6 weeks and make sure you have a job, okay? Rather than a policy that says, oh, no, don't work. Like, why would you be recruiting people that don't want to work?
It's one of those backwards, self-defeating positions. I've said this all along. I want the poorest, the most hungry, because when they come to this country, there should be, and I'm stealing from Chase a little bit on this one, there should be like 20 Ellis Island type things around the country where are established legal entry points for all these, even if you consider them, quote, an invasion. And I hate that word because I think it blends into that nationalism, that creeping nationalism that I can't stand. But let's have the least restrictive immigration policy possible. I agree with you. I don't agree with Jacob Hornberger. I love the guy. I've talked to him several times. But I think his whole let anyone across at any time, basically open border, typical anarchist position, I find too much. Even if you want to get there eventually, it's not going to happen in our lifetime. So you might as well make the best of it. At the same time, the old school, people seem to forget, at every point in our history, there's been anti-immigration fervor. It's always at a different group. It was the Germans, then the Irish, then the Italians, the Asians, the Japanese. There was always one targeted group that you couldn't stand if you were a, quote, Native American. If you were a true American, there was always some horrible, dirty immigrant group that was coming into our country and destroying it, by God, and we have to prevent them. And history has proven that to be false every single time. As libertarians, I hope, I pride ourselves as a group of people as being the more intellectual party, the people who can look at facts. You know, I take pride in that as a libertarian. And to call yourself a libertarian and be anti-immigrant, I had a rant on this last episode, Mike. I just don't see the connection between the two. I see it if you're a nationalist. I see it if you're a MAGA type. I see that where you could say, hey, we're the best, you know, even the idiots who are white makes right and all that sort of nonsense. I see it there. I don't see it with us. And it saddens me, really. Not for people who say Texas has a right to defend its borders. It does have a right to defend its borders. I have no issue with people who say, hey, it's a property rights issue, without directly quoting Hop or any of this nonsense. But just to say, okay, look, it's my property. It's my fence. It's my house. I don't want to get overrun. I get that as well.
Yep.
But this concept that this in itself is a plague on the U.S., that these poor people, not the ones that are being trafficked, because that's a different – I think that's a different bucket. That's not immigration. I think that's just a crime, right? You're kidnapping people. That's a crime. That's a different issue altogether. But immigration, poor people – there's a reason they come here. Now, if you, I agree, simultaneously took away the bad welfare policies, now the free market is saying, am I going to have a better life where I am right now? Or am I going to have a better life, a better opportunity, as hack as it sounds, to go to the U.S., find a job, find it legally, and build a life for myself? It's what my father did. It's what I'm sure at some point in your lineage, given your surname, your ancestors came over here for the same opportunity. So I take it very personally when people say, look at these horrible immigrants. And the fact that it's not pointed at my particular ethnic group, my particular cultural heritage, has nothing to do with it. So
it did at one point.
Absolutely. It did at one point. So when you say, look at all these poor, these horrible looking people, they're tattered. They're looking for work. They're so desperate. We don't need them. No, those are the people I want. Like, I want, like, when we had the mass immigration from Cuba, you know, like, yes, there was some of Castro emptying his jails onto the shores of Florida in 78 and 79.
And all of a sudden, we had an extra 300,000 libertarians in South Florida.
Well, that was the point, right? Like, those people, the ones who had to, who still had memories of the Bay of Pigs and understood what freedom meant and had to live under Castro's regime. They were some of the best Americans that ever hit these shores in that period of time.
Of course. That is exactly right. I couldn't agree with you anymore. Indeed, I wish that we were actively recruiting people from Haiti right now.
Yeah.
Because it's a twofer. There are people that need to get out of there, and immigration is good for the United States. And to your point and what we were discussing earlier, the least like us possible is the best type of the least that we have in common is the best type of immigration. And I agree with you. The people that we want most are the people that will do anything to get in the United, you know, my son's baseball coach was a guy who had to swim the last half mile. You get it. When the raft breaks up in the surf, and you're making a swim for it, hold that guy. I want that guy.
Yes, yes. I want that guy working for my company. Like the second his foot hits dry land, I want that guy working for me. You're absolutely right.
So, this case, running the business, actually, that the kids were working for. Because these people are naturally entrepreneurial. They start out entrepreneurial because we won't let them get a job, right? But it's the guy who, this was his third raft, by the way. The first two broke up in the surf in Cuba, right?
My goodness.
The third raft didn't break up until it made it to the Hollywood, Florida surf. And these are the people who just didn't get the memo that said, you can't start your own business. You can't be successful. You need to go to the right schools. You need to have connections. You need to speak English, right? These people didn't get that memo. And they are just naturally scrappy and entrepreneurial and bootstrapping their way into a better lives and for their families.
Agreed. Agreed 100%. And Mike, I'm going to give you the opportunity because I think I know your answer. But one sentence, the great replacement theory. Unfortunately, I hear that in so many libertarian Twitter, for lack of a better term. How much nonsense is the great replacement theory?
All of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why do we
keep hearing it, though?
I believe we will eventually discover that the answer is all of it. The only debate right now is whether it's, you know, all of it or most of it. Because the reason we keep hearing it is because it has been the case in the past that political parties have been able to gain ground among immigrants when the other party does a crappy job on immigration policy. In other words, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If, you know, we should really call this Party A and Party B because they have flipped in the past. But the most recent example, if the Republicans do a crappy job on immigration policy and treat immigrants effectively, disrespectfully, right?
Yes.
Then they are going to lose the immigrant vote to the Democratic Party. That's how it works. When you treat people like crap, they vote for someone else, right? So then you notice, well, gee, all the new immigrants are also voting for the Democratic Party. Oh, now I see why the Democratic Party is so fast to reach out to the, that's why they want people coming across the border faster. You get my point. It's really a Republican Party phenomenon, not a Democratic Party phenomenon. Now, we might well ask, why is it the Democratic Party, more limited to that, you know, why is it the White House hasn't been able to take care of business at the border as I believe that they should have been? I think that that's just a combination of being dopey and having bad policy.
Yeah, it's Yeah, it's a combination of bad politics because, I mean, forget the current situation. Go back to 1850, the Know Nothing Party. It was a party that was literally formed on the plank of we hate immigrants. That was their plank for the most part. They got Fillmore to run for them. What was it, in 1856, I think, after being president. Then he tried again. And that party was out of existence in 10 years. So there was enough anti-immigrant fervor to say, hey, we've got an actual political party. We've got a former president at the top of the ticket.
Great. And you know they were blaming other parties for bringing in immigrants to support them.
Right. And what happened to them? 10 years out of existence. Right. So I think your point is perfect. It's not a racial replacement. It's arbitrage in its purest sense, right? Yes. You're no Wall Street guy. It's arbitrage. It's like I see an opportunity to make – generally a profit in a market that's untapped, that's underutilized, underresearched, right? Underappreciated. It's the same thing with immigration policy. Democrats are like, I don't care that. Now, they happen to be from South America right now. But if those immigrants were coming, say, from Asia, it would be Asians.
Any Europe, other place.
Europe, right? So it's the racial component is what's objectionable in that theory because there isn't a plot to say we're shooting ourselves in the foot, white people. So, change your immigration policy. Like, what's more inane than that? But I understand that point. So, yeah, I view it as an arbitrage situation. Mike, that was great.
I do. And I think that this plays out in lots of other areas, not just in immigration.
I agree with you.
I think that the parties, once they make a mistake, once they alienate a certain group of people, then it's easy to say, well, the other party has crappy policy that does a bad job of reaching out to that group of people. And we believe that that's not good for our society. And that's the structural letterhead. And then you just put in different nouns and verbs in certain places. And it's the same thing.
Yeah. It's a mad lib of nonsense is what it comes down to. But you're absolutely right. All right. I want to end this now just on pure LP politics. I want to get some quick thoughts as we wrap up. How did you feel? I know you were out in at the California State Convention. I know you ran into my partner, William Del Pilar, out there.
He's good people, by the way.
Yeah, I think you would have liked him. He keeps telling me, goes, I'm a conservative, but that Termont, I kind of like him,
Well, his judgment may stink, but he's good people anyway. I think that we should have a podcast with him.
Oh, definitely. He'd be more than happy to join in. But the thing about the state convention in California, the invitation of non-libertarian candidates to share the stage with you and others, the exclusion of or the high bar to certain other libertarian presidential candidates. Talk to me a little bit about that. How do you feel about this flirtation with RFK? Now, I've heard the official position. Hey, the candidates at the nominating convention, if they want RFK, it's RFK. You'll hear McCardle say something like that. Personally, libertarian doesn't mean a free-for-all, pardon the pun. We're libertarians. We're a private organization. We should have, and we do have the right to say, hey, you're not one of us. You're not welcome at our party. Should that be the case with RFK, do you feel? And in general, how do you feel about this nominating process? Like, should it be more primary-based? Should it be more caucus-based? Should it be a state-by-state nomination process? Or do you enjoy this sort of old-school 1800s chaotic, the guy who can whip up the most tokens at the convention wins, that sort of thing.
I do like it. I don't think we should change it. I don't think that we should be going to a retail primary to work with your questions going backward.
Yeah, sure.
We can come back to that if you want. I do actually like the process very much for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is that I actually enjoy the process. So that's a little bit of a bias. Maybe you should ask me a year from now when I won't be so enamored of actually going through the blocking and tackling of it because I do enjoy it a lot. But I think more important than that is that we don't want to be in a position where we're going to get a nominee because he or she was the only one with the money to run a retail campaign before the nomination. when the reason we're picking someone in the nomination process is because they're the most likely to be able to bring in the money that we don't otherwise have. Hmm. Because right now in the Republican and Democratic parties, the way that works is, you know, you're not even participating until you've raised $10 million.
Right.
Okay. So that's how you're going to pick a Libertarian, is because you're not going to have many. You're not going to have five. You're not going to have Ron DeSantis and Donald Trump and Nikki Haley and Vivek Ramaswamy and, you know, all of these people competing with, you know, dozens of millions of dollars each.
Right.
To see who can win a, there's going to be one person who's able to plop down $1 million and they're automatically going to win, and love it or shove it, that's going to be your candidate. I don't like that process. So I think that we're better off with the process of an open convention and choosing someone who is the most logical standard bearer for bringing in that kind of money to our party that wouldn't otherwise be coming in. So to work backwards. Now, regarding RFK, I have a little bit of a different take than a lot of other people do. And that's because I need to say a couple things about RFK.
Sure.
One is he's not a libertarian. And with a capital L or a lowercase L, he's just not.
Right.
And I think that the more you learn about him, the more that is apparent. And so having taken a look at him, I didn't feel very threatened. But if he did seek the Libertarian Party's presidential nomination, I think he would lose. I don't think he would secure it. And I don't think there's an amount of money that would change that. I think you could quite literally spend $100 million lobbying a couple of thousand people, right? I mean, you could buy each one of them a house, but I just don't think that they would vote for him. At the end of the day, I just don't think that that would work.
But are you concerned that one of the troubling signs I see in the LP is that a lot of people who identify as libertarians are increasingly becoming one or two issue libertarians, meaning someone like RFK can go in there and say, look, man, I hate vaccines and I've hated vaccines since day one. Never mind that, you know, prior to this, I was considered a kook, right? I just happened to hit the right sort of zeitgeist with COVID.
Right. Right.
But when it came to vaccines and autism, vaccines and polio and all that, he also denies all that stuff, right? So he's a one, if anything, he's a one issue libertarian, right? Like
That's all right.
Of a sudden we're forgetting that he promoted national service, mandatory national service at
mandatory
one point.
Mandatory national service, not just thought it was a good idea.
Yeah. So, I mean,
And a huge regulatory structure in the green area.
Yeah. He's from the Kennedy tradition.
And a blank check for Tel Aviv, for Jerusalem.
Yeah. Right.
No,
right.
I get all that. Yes.
But is that troubling to you that there seems to be more and more libertarians who are like, as long as we align with a candidate on one issue that's important to us, almost like the abortion litmus test for Republicans, say, or for Democrats, the healthcare, right?
Yeah.
Like, I find that abhorrent, but I unfortunately, Mike, please tell me it's just my ridiculous way of viewing things, because I really want to be proven wrong. Do you feel in your travels, when you talk to people, that we are seeing more and more libertarians, so-called libertarians, who are one-issue libertarians, that ends up damaging the party? Because as you know, these local state chapters and everything, there's only like six people, a dozen in some cases, that go to these things. So it becomes very easy for these one issue people, I call them MAGA plants, that'll come in, they'll say, look, we support Texas's right to defend itself. And the next thing you know, there's a bunch of Trump guys running the Libertarian Party of so-and-so county, right?
Right.
So do you see that as an issue? A problem,
no.
Potentially.
Yes.
Good. Okay.
Yes. No. Look,
prove me wrong, Mike.
You speak truth that can happen, that has happened, it does happen. I'm not as concerned about it, maybe as you are, because we don't have retail primaries, so we have a lot of people that are more concerned with more than one issue. the responsibility that we vest in these thousand people or a couple thousand people from whom the thousand are drawn is taken more seriously because it is an open convention and each person does have more responsibility. And that's another reason why I like the style of campaigning that we go through rather than at the retail primary level where you're just throwing a lot of money at it and hoping that your advertising sticks. You know, for us, for an individual to win the nomination, you've got to go and physically touch them three times or they don't feel like they know you. And I think that that is very, very important. In the case of RFK, I view him more as entertainment. In other words, in California, you know, the same way that you would invite,
right?
You know, you would pay $10,000 to get a big comedian there and hope that you can sell tickets and there's going to be more people in the audience and it's going to be fun and more people will come back next time.
But the problem is that you wouldn't say, but now this comedian that I invited to entertain is going to be my standard bearer, though. Like, I'm all in on the comedian aspect of your analogy. It's the, like, why can't we get the thing of, like, yeah, we're willing to debate him on ideological issues more than have him, Cornel West, Jill Stein, all of them. Let's prove libertarianism, individualism, Trump, statism, and socialism, and communism. I'm all for that. Do we need to say, well, if he can somehow pull it off in Washington, he's our guy? Do we need to start sort of not? In other words, I would have thought that the position of the party, I'm not any one person, but in general, would be like, hey, we're willing to debate RFK. He's not a libertarian, though. I agree with you. He's not a libertarian.
I think that is the position of the Libertarian Party.
Okay. I'm not getting that vibe. I don't think
most people are having it. They're, you know, if he, and he may, right? I mean, I could be wrong, and that he will be nominated on the floor. He will accept that nomination on the floor to be included in the vote for who's going to be the nominee. And he will get 100, 200, 300 votes, right? But he's not going to pick up second place votes as other candidates drop out. I don't think there's a way for him to get to the 50% mark. I don't think he's going to win. And so if we invited a comedian, back to my analogy, to speak to us in California or any other convention, and then that person turned around and decided to run for president, I'm okay with that. I'm much more okay with that than a gatekeeping process, right? In fact, you know, maybe I'm one of the gatekeepers and I make a mistake and I, you know, lock someone out who could have grown a little bit and turned into a, you know, what do I know, right?
Right.
I'm more comfortable without a gatekeeping process. You brought up some other issues that we haven't touched on. I don't like the idea that we're going to gatekeep on who gets to participate in the process, right? Now, having said that, it's not easy to not gatekeep. There are a lot, I'm told there's something like 20, I don't know if this is true or not. Someone recently told me there's like 20 people seeking Libertarian Party nominations.
Oh, it's a lot. Yeah, it's a lot. Yeah.
What if all 20 showed up one day and demanded to be in the debate? I don't know what I would do if I were running a state convention. Maybe the only good answer is you let them all part. I don't know, but that either you only get 20 seconds with each candidate or else you're there for 7 hours. I don't know a great answer to that. You probably do need some way of saying we're only going to allow in, and then you got to pick a number, right? 2, 4, 6, 8.
Didn't Texas have, to me, it was the first time I saw it, but wasn't the Texas process, we're having four people on the debate stage and it'll be the top four fundraisers for the state party, right? So,
right.
And were you, I think you were part of that, right?
I think I came in second.
Second, right. I knew you made the cut is what I'm saying. So to answer your question, maybe that technically might be a gatekeeping process, but it seems to me to be one where human feelings aren't involved in that, right? That's very cut and dried. If you know those are the rules coming in, if I want to participate in the state of Texas libertarian debate, I have to be one of the top four fundraisers for the state party. And at least that puts some seriousness on it, right? Not just anybody can show up, to your point. We're not going to have 40 people on the stage, 20 people on the stage, because right. then it becomes chaos. So I get it that, but you know, as an old coder, you have decision-making based on facts and you have, you know, without intuition being involved. So you could say, if candidate A can accomplish this, then he or she is in. If they fail to accomplish this whatever task, you know, now you could always have the question is who sets the task, who sets the bar, but at least if it's not a moving target, I think that would be fairer for everybody. And it would maintain a level of seriousness, right? I think one of the things I keep saying, and I know I'm throwing smoke your way a little bit. One of the thing about this year's crop of candidates, for the most part, you guys all look like serious candidates. You put on a jacket, you put on a tie, you're not showing up wearing a boot on your head. You're not, you know, you're not out there, you know, with an M16 on stage, you know, to prove a point. Like that sort of silly theater is lacking. And it's been lacking, say, for the last 2-3 cycles. So I think as a political party, to the non-libertarian, to the non-political junkie, all of a sudden libertarian candidates look a lot more like, these might be some people I need to listen to consider their viewpoints and to listen to their message, which, you know, any marketer will tell you, if you fail that initial eyeball test, you're not going to get anybody to listen to you, right? Like, it is what it is. It's human nature. So to that extent, I appreciate that. So I don't know. Do we have a gatekeeping bar that says no shoes, no shirt, no tie, no debate? Maybe that's one that everyone can agree to, or to the fundraising point. Like, how do you feel about something like that? Like, just have these relatively objective standards that people can meet.
I like objective standards. I thought you were making the case for subjective standards there at the end, because, you know, if you actually include, you know, how we feel about people, then, you know, it's a slippery slope, right?
Right, right.
And in fairness to our friends in California, they did, we might not like the process, might not like the fact that there was gatekeeping, but they did have an objective process in place, and it just turned out that some people didn't like it. Mm. And, you know, I didn't like paying the fee either, right? You know, but that's more because I'm a cheap SOB, more than I thought it was unfair, right?
Right, 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 you know,
at no point did I say it's not fair. I just said I didn't want to pay. So, you know, that's kind of a different argument, right?
Right. Well, to be fair to some of the other candidates, I believe their beef was that it was a sliding fee scale. Like, if it was like X amount for everybody, I think more
it
people
was.
Would have been. Oh, because I've heard allegations that it wasn't. I don't know if that's true or not. Okay.
Everyone had the chance to pay, and we all said no. And then the weeks went on, and they came back, and we said no again. And I caved thinking I was the last to cave. Mm. And it turns out I was the first to cave, about which I am totally embarrassed because I pride myself on being cheap and ornery. And I even had to apologize to them for the number of times I said no and you know, how vociferous I was in my complaining and whining.
Yeah.
And they said, no, actually, you know, you were the first to cave. And I'm like, oh, my Lord, don't tell anyone. I was the...
So everybody else has you to blame.
I was the first to cave. And then Michael caved. And and that's when they cut the deal with RFK. And then they got themselves boxed in where they had to make a promise to him being right. the entertainment.
Right.
They had to make the promise to him that the panel was going to consist of what he agreed to, because he didn't want to be on a panel with 15 people. I exaggerate, but you get the point.
Right.
And they didn't feel like they could go back to him and change the rules. And so then they found themselves creating other panels for people who caved later than we did. So, you know, you might not like the, I didn't like the process. I didn't like, I never, there are people, I know there are people watching your show now who know damned well that in every other state I have complained.
Yeah.
You know, there, you know, Nevada wanted $50 and I complained. I mean, I guess, you know, you pull the string out of the back of the Economist and he complains, you know, and I tell the team all the time, no matter what number they give you, you say, oh my Lord, that is too, that's, Mike's not going to like that. We can't pay that. I don't care if it's $11. You complain about that number and you complain whether it's $11,000 or $11. So yeah, I complained, but that wasn't because of a sense of unfairness. I was just not wanting to pay.
Well, Mike, you know what? You could tell Gabrielle it's always free to come on my show for you. I will never charge you a fee to.
Well,
to,
when you do, appear. I will complain. I will eventually pay. Now you know I will eventually break down and pay, but I will complain along the way.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, here's the thing, though, Mike. It's been a pleasure talking to you so far. I enjoy talking to you. I love having you on. You're one of my favorite guests. I'm not ashamed to say that. Thank you for joining us today. Please let everyone know, how's your campaign doing? How can they reach your campaign and how can they donate to your campaign?
The campaign is doing great. We got 20 people on our team that we pay some amount of money. They think it's hardly anything. I think it's too much. I complain every month when I pay them. We send them a check or we Zelle them or something. And I say, this is too much. You're not working hard enough. We're going to reduce the amount. I just complain all the time. But if you would like to join this team, and either as a volunteer or to receive a check and your monthly complaint from me, we would love to have our team expand even further. We not only have professionals on our team, we've got volunteers. We have a group of advisors who are unpaid. And so it's a big team, you know, at this point. We are, how do I say, almost ready for the general election. We're ahead of schedule in terms of our planning and preparation, but I would not argue that we would be ready for the general tomorrow morning, but we're getting there. And like I say, ahead of schedule. So if anyone would like to be a part of that, let me know. Go to the website. MikeTremont.com is hard to spell because there's two A's in Tremont, but easier to spell is goldnewdeal.org. Gold New Deal is, of course, what we call our platform. We're obviously making fun of the New Deal and we're making fun of AOC's Green New Deal a little bit because we do believe we need a fundamentally different relationship between us and the government. So go to goldnewdeal.org and the two websites, you can flip back and forth. See what you like there. My real contact information is there. That's not fake. You can drop me a text, drop me an email. If anyone out there would like to support the campaign, if anyone out there has some money that is really annoying you and you need a way to get rid of it, there is a way to do that on the website. And if you just have questions or comments, you know, if you just want to drop me an email and make fun of Big John, you know, we're starting a Discord channel just to make fun of Big John. And
oh,
it's
going
to be very, very popular.
Mike, I'm an old fantasy football guy. That's where I made my bones in media. So I am used to the abuse. Every time I gave the wrong guy to start on your fantasy lineup, I would hear about it the next day because it costs people money. So I doubt there's any damage that Discord, but I welcome it. I welcome it.
Oh, I hear you. I'm still grumpy. My Virginia Cavaliers lost to Colorado State the other day.
Are you feeling good about your Cubbies, though?
I always feel good about the Cubbies. The Cubbies are going to win this year, John.
And that's why we want Mike Tremont at the top of this ticket. He's a perpetual optimist if he thinks the Cubs are going to do well this year. But we love him for it anyway. Mike, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. Always great to talk to you. And looking forward to the next round of questions here on Free for All. For everyone else, come join us next week for another episode of Free for All. Check us out at grumblingsmedia.com. You can find us on YouTube, Rumble, all the social media handles. Just look for @grumblingsmedia, one word. And once again, Mike Tremont, thank you, and good luck the rest of the way to the campaign.
Thank you.
Peace out, everyone.
Take care.